Coffee USA magazine, and I'm doing a graphic novel called King of RPGs, coming out from Delray next year. And before that, I worked for Viz for 10 years, and I edited Shonen Jump magazine, Dragon Ball, Yu-Gi-Oh, Naruto, One Piece, Shaman King, Full Metal Alchemist, and a bunch of other manga. A bunch of other manga, and one of which only one was a shoujo manga, that was Hanakimi. So yeah, I've pretty much been working in manga all my life, and over that period, I've gotten to meet lots of strange and mysterious individuals who work in the manga industry, and who have worked in the manga industry since like the dawn of time in the 80s when manga was just starting to appear. So, as I already explained to most of you, I'm Jason Thompson, and this is my history of manga in the U.S. and how it came to the U.S. Alright, actually, the history of manga and anime in the U.S. starts out interconnected, and now, with each table slap, we will progress with the slide. Alright, so yeah, obviously, so today, manga is super popular. This is like the bookstore a couple blocks down from my house. And, once, of course, manga was hardly known by anyone in America, and it's had a long uphill battle to become as popular as it has. So, how did it happen? I'm going to tell you today, so that you can pass it on to future generations. And to go back, to start, we have to go back to 1963. Alright. So 1963 was the year that the first Japanese animation actually appeared on U.S. television. And the first one was Astro Boy, which was also one of the first animated shows produced in Japan, period. It was quickly brought over, but most Americans had no idea that it was originally based on a Japanese comic, which ran in Shonen magazine. The same applied to a lot of other early anime that was based in manga, and this really, really early pre-boom of anime series, like Kimba of the White Lion, which is also based on another one of Tezuka's manga, and The Gigantor, which is based on a manga by Mitsuhiro Yokoyama, and was another popular show at the time. But the actual comics based on this stuff were not being brought over. Because American comics, they had a very different format, and they were used to being color, and they were used to being really short, unlike the long serial stories in manga. And the level of violence and the other kind of objectionable content was a bit of an issue too. So typically, what they would do is just hire a American artist to redraw the entire thing from scratch, like in this licensed Astro Boy comic that Gold Key released back in the 60s. The actual Astro Boy didn't get to come out in English until nearly 40 years later when Dark Horse released it. Alright, just to let you know, this is all a different time. This is the voice acting staff of Kimba the White Lion. I think Seth is there in the background, in one of his early roles before he became a cartoonist. Alright, but actually, even back at this time, there were some people who were starting to become fans of manga. Basically, the manga that was available in the U.S. at the time was mostly stuff sold to Japanese people in Japanese bookstores. Whoa!
Sorry, you know what? We got you a Koji
Momo
thing.
I don't have to do this like...
Although, if you want to be added...
I don't have to do this like Taiko.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Whoa.
For you.
Oh, man, this is awesome.
This is
horrible.
Cool. Technology
tomorrow,
today.
Alright, great. Alright.
You don't need your mic, right?
No, I think I'm doing okay. Alright, thank you, Lillian. You can go now. You've been downsized. Okay. So there was a lot of manga available in Japanese bookstores in places with large Japanese communities, untranslated, of course. And some fans, did become aware of this, and some English speakers were starting to pick it up. One of the first manga fans was Fred Patton, who went on to found the Cartoon Fantasy Organization, the first anime club in the U.S. And he became a fan of Takao Saito's manga adaptation of The Man from U.N.C.L.E., or as it's known in Japan, 0011 Napoleon Solo. Anyway, so he soon went on to become a fan of manga in general, and he also was working at a mail-order comic book store called Wonderworld Books, which specialized in selling international comics from around the world. Mostly they were European comics, but he introduced them to manga, and they got hooked up with a bunch of Japanese publishers, and they started to basically sell untranslated manga, you know, by catalog, but aimed at, you know, American comic collectors for the first time. And as I mentioned, he also founded the first anime club. Back in the days of the 70s when commercial VCRs were just starting to come into existence. And that's the Cartoon Fantasy Organization's mascot down there in the lower right-hand corner. And that is Fanta, their kind of like space otter mascot. Fred Patton, not only a pioneer in anime fandom, but he was one of America's first furry fandom people. So as you can see, he's also famous for editing anthologies of anthropomorphic fox fiction and stuff like that. And also, other people associated with him were like Joshua Quagmire, who did this book called Cutie Bunny, which in which Osamu Tezuka sent him a fan letter. And of course, Tezuka himself, you know, can be sort of seen as a precursor of the furry phenomenon. You know, basically taking like cartoony stuff, you know, like cartoon animals, and you know, adultizing it up. Which is a sort of a, you know, aspect of both manga and a furry fandom. So here we see Tezuka kind of getting his furry side on, and he steals from Phoenix and Ode to Kirihito. But there's of course many other aspects of Japanese comics. Another one at the time, which had become quite popular, was the violent, really violent and, you know, adult, you know, dramas like Lone Wolf and Cub, which was running in the early 70s. And one of the early manga fans who discovered it was Vernon Grant, who was in Japan in the army, and he wrote a couple of articles about Lone Wolf and Cub for the Mainichi Shimbun, and he went on to do his own underground comics a little after that. So Lone Wolf and Cub introduced, you know, more. I mean, it wasn't the first comic like this, but I mean, it was one of the most popular. It introduced the more realistic art style, and also a lot of the motion conventions that we see in manga today, the speed lines and the like cinematic action and that kind of stuff. And America at the time was coincidentally going through a sort of big boom in Asian martial arts. So it didn't take long for some artists like Archie Goodwin and Walt Simonson to actually start reading a little manga and sort of adapting it in a very, very very, very modified way in the comics like Manhunter, which was a DC comic back in the 70s, featuring an extremely non-subtle looking ninja, as a white ninja, of course, as the hero. And other people who were getting into manga fandom at the time included Wind the Peonies, the creators of ElfQuest. Kamui was one of their favorite manga, Kamui being the story of a rogue ninja. By Sanpei Shirako, another really popular manga of the 60s and 70s. And actually, the main elf in ElfQuest does kind of look kind of like Kamui with those elf ears. So they were fans of manga from way back. 1978 was when the first manga was actually translated for English-speaking audiences. And that was Barefoot Gen. And his cartoon story of Hiroshima, which is actually now published by Last Gasp, but it was originally published by a small anti-nuclear organization who was aware of this comic, and they thought it would be a good way to spread awareness about the fact that nuclear war sucks. And this is actually a pretty unique and incredible comic if you've ever seen it. It's written by Keiji Nakazawa, who was a actual survivor of Hiroshima, and went on to write about it in manga form. So it's a very graphic story. It's very, very, you know, has really gruesome depictions of the effects of the bombing, and this kid's, half of his family dies, and he and his mother have to struggle to survive in the ruins and, you know, in the post-war reconstruction of Japan. Oddly enough, this really dramatic and dark manga ran, of course, and Shonen Jump, the manga magazine where One Piece, Dragon Ball, etc., and all the like other super, super popular anime adapted manga run today. And there's just some Shonen Jumps from the 70s when Barefoot Begin was running. So, but actually, it was a different time. Political subject matter was more accepted in manga, and, you know, it was just coming off of the wave of the underground comics and, you know, the hippie movement in Japan in the 60s and 70s. So there was a lot of stuff like that. And also Barefoot Again, although it is about the Hiroshima bombing, it's still a very, like, shonen manga story where they struggle to survive. You know, it's very optimistic, even though everyone dies horribly in the first volume. But then after that, it gets a lot better. Another manga artist who was getting really popular in the 70s was Monkey Punch, the creator of Lupin the Third. And Lupin the Third is actually very influenced by American comics like Mad Magazine. And so Monkey Punch actually took the opportunity in the late 70s to go to a trip to America, and he wrote about it for Animage Magazine. And so here's his little narrative of his trip to America, which he spent in California meeting some of his favorite artists, going to comic shops, meeting underground comic artists. He went to a science fiction convention in L.A., there he is. Welcome, Mr. Monkey. And, and he had a great time. In the last panel, he says, "See you again, USA!" And he did go to come again, and he brought a friend. And in 1980, the San Diego Comic-Con included the first lineup of actual manga artists as a program of an actual U.S. convention. Monkey Punch and Osamu Tezuka, and some other people who didn't go on to be as popular, like Shinobu Kaze. Of course, Comic-Con, Comic-Con wasn't as big as it is now, but it was still a huge convention, and the Japanese artists, you know, were a little bit, you know, lost in all the waves of superheroes. I mean, because superhero comic publishers at the time were aware of the existence of this huge comic market in Japan, but they weren't really interested in bringing stuff over. I mean, they were interested in selling their stuff in Japan, like with, you know, the Batman manga adaptation that recently got brought over by DC, or like the Spider-Man manga adaptation by Ryuichi Ikegami, of all people, which was brought over by Marvel a couple of years ago. Although they had to stop publishing it in the middle because the Japanese writers started to take it in a more dark direction. It was like Peter Parker, like, you know, stalking girls and, like, you know, terrorists and, you know, him, like, joining a biker gang. He never wears a Spider-Man costume. And anyway, so this is from the beginning, before it starts to go really nuts. Before it turns into Wounded Man or Crying Freeman. So yeah, Marvel was also, you know, bringing over Japanese properties, but they were doing original comics based on them, you know, like these Godzilla comics and the Shogun Warriors, one of the early Japanese robot toys. But there were some artists working in American mainstream comics who were fans of manga, and one of the most popular was Frank Miller. And Frank Miller, of course, is the creator of Sin City and 300 and the director of Spirit, but let's not talk about that. He was a fan of the Lone Wolf and Cub in particular, and he really liked the storytelling and the art and the violence. And at the time, he was working on Daredevil, and sort of started turning it into he sort of, you know, consciously knowing that, like, Asian stuff was in, but also being a big fan of manga, he started adding more and more, like, ninja and, you know, like, Asian elements, so to speak, into Daredevil, and also a certain amount of manga-style storytelling. And it became really popular. And the sort of ultimate evolution of his manga phase at the time was Ronin, with his science fiction, post-apocalyptic samurai graphic novel of the 80s, which was a big hit when it came out. Other people at the time who were discovering manga included Colleen Doran and Scott McCloud, people like that. But Frank Miller's ninjaization of American comics had a lot of it influenced a lot of people. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Tick, which originally had a hella ninja in the original comic version, but not in either the anime or the live action version. And however, if you wanted to find actual manga in this period, it was pretty hard to find. There were a few books published in like almost vanity editions, like there's a single volume of Devilman or Manga, which was an anthology magazine. Some manga stories and things like Heavy Metal, and also bilingual editions like the Urusei Yatsura bilingual manga, which were intended for sale in Japan, so Japanese speakers could practice their English. Around this time, the first shoujo manga got translated. That was The Rose of Versailles. This really, really awesome story, if you haven't read it, about the French Revolution. That was published in an abridged edition, also in Japan. It was translated by Frederick Schott, who went on to become way more famous for his awesome book, Manga Manga, The World of Japanese Comics, which is still a definitive book on manga. And Fred Schott lived in Japan in the 70s as a university student, and he got to meet Osamu Tezuka, a lot of incredible people. And his book's an incredible snapshot of the manga industry up through the 80s, and he's still active today. But meanwhile, back in comics lands, you know, the next big thing was like giant robot toys, and so you know, we had Transformers and Star Wars comics based on loosely on Japanese properties. And things started to get a little more openly Japanese when Robotech and Macross came out. And, you know, because that had a real cult following, and it also, you know, we started to see now the anime eyes also appearing in the actual, you know, American spin-off licensed adaptations, as opposed to them growing in, you know, in a more, like, traditional Marvel comic American style. And so the big robot thing went on, you know, to be imitative of other American comic artists. And also we got to see more adaptations of Japanese shows which people knew were popular, like the Speed Racer manga or the original Astro Boy, which is not actually the original Astro Boy. It's drawn by some American dude whose name I forget. And a little bit of manga was published, like the Golgo 13 manga, which was published to coincide with the release of the Nintendo game. 1987, when it all changed. Alright, so in 1987, Lone Wolf and Cub was translated for the first time. And it had a big audience, because Frank Miller, who is the real superstar, had been talking in the press for so long. And First Comics, a comics company that doesn't exist anymore, and didn't do any other manga, managed to get the rights, and they started releasing it. And it was really popular. I mean, it's an excellent comic. And also the fact that Frank Miller did the covers probably sold it like by itself. So it was the best-selling manga in America for many years. Although they never finished it. It took until Dark Horse came along to actually finish the series. But meanwhile, another company was starting. This company was Viz, which was founded by Seiji Horiguchi. This is his sort of autobiographical book, which isn't translated, called Moeru America, which is about the founding of Viz. And as Seiji points out, his favorite manga was Domu by Katsuhiro Otomo, because it portrays a science fiction world strongly influenced by the New Age movement and you know, psychic powers and stuff. Because Seiji was strongly influenced by the New Age movement. This is him and the co-founder of this, Satoru Fuji, in 2001, when the company was really successful. And this is them 20 years earlier, and they were both living on a commune in the hills of California. So they met at the Waseda University Folk Songs Club, and then they ended up becoming manga publishers later on. But this is the this was the 80s, and this is Northern California. So there were many other hippies working in comic publishing, like these people at Eclipse Comics. Eclipse Comics today it's closed down, and the building's now being used as a magic shop, which is run by one of the former proprietors. But at the time, it was one of the fairly big indie comics publishers. And Seiji and Satoru, the founders of Viz, realized they didn't really have any idea of how to break into the American market. They weren't familiar with you know, how it worked. So they basically hooked up with these people at Eclipse Comics, who basically co-published with them for a year. They had a year-long deal. And one of the other people at Eclipse, like basically working in the stockroom, was James Hudnall, who was the anime and manga fan at Eclipse, who kind of passed all this along and went on to become a comics writer to a certain extent himself. And James Hudnall also claims that he had actually been writing letters to Japanese publishers before then, trying to convince them to enter the American comics market, which at the time was going through this like boom of indie comics, the black and white boom, because it was considered acceptable to publish comics in black and white as opposed to, you know, them being just like a cheap substitute for color comics. So is it possible that James Hudnall's letters to the publishers were why these Japanese publishers contacted Seiji and Satoru and why Viz got started in the first place? But there's conflicting stories. Anyways, one of James Hudnall's friends was Torrin Smith, James Hudnall got into manga. And he was such a big fan, he was such a weeaboo that he actually went to Japan in the early 80s just to like meet up with people in the manga and anime industry and make contacts. And one of the people that he met was some of the founders of Gainax. And he made such an impression, he went on to become a character in Gunbuster, Smith Torrin. He was accorded a rare honor. Anyways, so when he got back, he started working for Eclipse and Viz too, and one of the things he was sort of put in charge of was how to basically change the format of Japanese comics. Because, Japanese comics, of course, you know, they're published in big magazine editions, and then they're published in tankobon graphic novel editions, like these. But at the time, the American comics market was only, you know, was only hospitable to stuff that's published in like 32-page pamphlet format like this. So, Torrin Smith and his wife, Tomoyuki Saito, kind of figured out how they would do it, and this became the standard for the next 10 years. Alright, so this is how manga was localized in like the 80s and 90s, by Tomoyuki Saito. So first, in the right panel, you see some American dude reading some manga and not understanding it. And you can tell he's American because he has a big nose and freckles, and slightly curly hair. And then there's the rights getting process where people are arguing over money. Okay, and then we get to the point where this is the pre-digital age, so nothing was lettered digitally. They get the stats from Japan. They get like big photocopy high quality proofs from Japan, the manga. Then they photographically flip them left to right because this is the age when people believe that no one would ever read manga if it's printed right to left. So in order not to weird out Americans, they flip mirror imaged everything. Then they would manually retouch the dialogue, again, because digital stuff wasn't as advanced at the time. And then they would package it as Super Tummy Yumiko, which you may remember as not existing. And then in the middle panel, the creature is like, 32 pages for 300 yen? What the hell? It's expensive. And then, you know, Tomoyuki is like, well, that's just the way the American market is. I'm sorry, I know it sucks. Because, yeah, at this point, manga was being sold in, like, 32-page, 24-page chunks, which is, like, $2.95. The standard going American indie comics rate. Anyways, the manga that Viz put out at the time, the first manga that Viz put out, back in those days of 87, was Kamui, the ninja comic, which is drawn in a style similar to Lone Wolf and Cub. They did Mai, the psychic girl. If you can read the text on the left, it reads, she is pretty. She is psychic. She is Japanese. And so these comics are both picked because they kind of looked more American, they looked more Western style and more realistic artwork. But another comic, Area 88, which came out, had a little bit more, you know, traditional but old school 70s manga look. And now this is 87, the land of manga. There's just two publishers chugging along. In 1988, things started to get crazy. Here's Viz in the late 80s. Viz published Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, and while they were publishing it, they had a dispute with Torrin Smith, who wanted to work on Nausicaa, and Viz wanted someone else to work on Nausicaa. And Torrin ended up leaving Viz, he had always been a freelancer, but he ended up leaving Viz and forming his own company, Studio Proteus, which went on to work for Dark Horse, and published a lot of popular manga for Dark Horse and Eclipse, like Appleseed, one of the first Masamune Shirow comics published. And so other people started publishing manga too. Dark Horse did a Godzilla manga. Marvel Comics published Akira, which was a really big deal at the time, because, I mean, they're Marvel Comics. But since they're Marvel Comics, you know, one of the things they insisted was Akira should be in color, that way it's going to be more popular. So they colorized it. At the time, it was considered a really good digital coloring job. And Viz was also experimenting with colorizing manga at this time. But in the end, they realized that it wasn't increasing sales, and that it kind of made the manga look muddy and blurry. So the actual original Speed Racer manga finally got to come out at this point. Three by Three Eyes was another series that Torrin Smith did with Studio Proteus for a small company called Innovation. Up in the upper left is a kind of weird magazine called Mangajin, which lasted for about 7 years. Mangajin was a magazine that printed manga, not for like basically story and entertainment, but it was as a teaching tool for people who wanted to learn Japanese for business purposes, and it would give lots of examples of how dialogue was written in manga, and you'd get to read like 4 or 8 pages of little manga stories and lots of articles about Japanese stuff. So this is a pretty cute magazine. It's pretty interesting. And at the time, of course, Japan was considered to be the U.S. economic rival, so everyone wanted to learn, everyone was either like paranoid and racist, or they wanted to learn Japanese or both. And a good example of this was, there was a comic done about this, Japan Inc., An Introduction to Japanese Economics by Shotaro Ishinomori, which actually came out in 1988. And pretty much nobody read it. But this is all, this is like a really transcendent business comic, and it's all full of stories about U.S.-Japan relations, like the scene where the U.S. auto workers are rioting, they're angry at Japanese cars. And that was kind of unique. And the racism spilled over into Eclipse Comics, who, when the Viz ended their license with them, they couldn't resist doing taking a party shot at Viz and doing adolescent radioactive black belt hamsters, Massacre of the Japanese Invasion, which is about as good as it sounds. Anyways, so a couple of manga publishers are starting to rise up. One of the first professional anime magazines appeared at this time. Another one was Protocol Stratic, which is still going today. I worked with the people at Animerica at Viz. Originally, it was a zine called Animag. Trish LeDoux, the founder of Animerica and a big Viz editor, also briefly worked as a voice actress, playing Khan, the sexy alien girl in Outlanders. Another dude at Viz who I knew, Carl Gustav Horn, who has buttons made in his name, went on to work at Dark Horse. He's now in charge of Dark Horse's translated manga line. And he is a devoted fan of both the early 90s rap music and also manga. Other publishers sprung up with the short-lived Sun Comics, Blast Books, which published a lot of horror and the Arrow Girl manga, a lot of really graphic and weird stuff. And Arctic Press started out as a company publishing manga-style, manga-influenced comics by Ben Dunn. Then it went on to publish some manga of their own, like Sylvester. Then in the mid-90s, they kind of split off into several different companies due to personal reasons. One of them was Studio Iron Cat, and these companies were all publishing pretty small manga artists. I mean, they really had personal connections to the artists. They couldn't get deals with the big publishers, so they would just, it was mostly like people they knew from doujinshi in Japan and stuff. And so they had a sort of a small press kind of personal touch where you might even see the artist herself, Pongi Bang, like posing in long cosplay on the back of an ad just to, get people to buy her comics, which you probably wouldn't see for the creator of Fushigi Yugi. And another spinoff of Antarctic Press was Radio Comics, who went on to publish furry manga and furry comics, and so the furry chain of evolution continued. Alright, another thing though going on at the time, Japanese video games totally seeping into the U.S. like mainstream in the 90s. Nintendo Power published a bunch of manga, like the Super Mario Adventures. Viz published a short-lived video game magazine called Game On USA that I actually edited. And also anime was becoming more popular. It was starting to really take off in video stores. Ghost in the Shell was briefly the best-selling video for, I think, 1 week in 1996. So people's awareness of manga was starting to grow. Although people didn't often know exactly what manga meant, because, we had companies like Manga Entertainment and U.S. Manga Corps, who were both actually anime companies and did not actually publish any manga at the time. And we see the logo of Manga Entertainment, the Manga Man, who does really not look like a manga character at all. He really looks like something from the British magazine 2000 AD. That's the Manga Man. But anyway, CPM, Central Park Media, they went on to actually form a manga company, although unfortunately they just filed for bankruptcy earlier this year. But at the time, manga was starting to become cool, or it was cool as part of this gestalt of video games and anime and everything. And so we had artists like Joe Matarazzo saying they were going to make X-Men into a manga book, stuff to speed lines and stuff. And we had titles like Manga She, and Manga Spawn. I guess it's manga because he's a mecha, so that must make him a manga. And we had stuff like X-Men manga, which was actually translated Japanese comics, so it was kind of bad, but kind of interesting. And the Marvel Mangaverse. So we had, suddenly manga was like this totally hip catchphrase, but were people buying actual manga? That's a good question. As Adam Warren, creator of Empowered, put it, so at one point, editors wouldn't piss on you if you were on fire, if you were working in the manga style. So, very cynical man. Anyways, by 1996, manga was still continuing to rise. The American comics market kind of had a plummet and land around like 95 because of this speculation crash and a lot of other issues, but manga was sort of holding on. 1997. All right, do you recognize this guy? All right, this is Stu Levy, CEO of a little company called Mix Entertainment. In 1997, he announced that he basically decided to launch this company with this manga magazine, which was like 200 pages long and contained a bunch of serialized stories, just like manga magazines from Japan, and unlike single story American comic books. Mixing. And Viz had tried anthology magazines before in the past, like Manga Vision and Pulp, but they hadn't been very successful. But Mixing had something different, which was shoujo manga. They were the first people to really publish shoujo manga, and like, you know, really, 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 really flowery and, you know, and basically pretty good shoujo manga, like Magic Knight Raiders and Sailor Moon, which had developed this huge fan following in like 95 when it showed up on American television, but then it, you know, it was never released for a second season. So suddenly this tremendous army of fangirls started to scour the internet and everywhere for more Sailor Moon information. And Mixing was there for them. So shoujo manga, of course, is like a whole parallel evolutionary path from like boys manga. And it's, you know, and yeah, it is a force not to be denied. And American publishers always thought that they would never be translated, but in fact, to their surprise, some of the stories that were popular in the early days of manga were stuff that, while not shoujo, was like romantic comedies and things that did have a certain corrupt gender appeal. As opposed to the ninja and like war and like giant robot stories that they had thought would be popular. So stuff like Rumiko Takahashi's early work was very popular. Also, Oh My Goddess, published by Dark Horse. Dark Horse had so little faith in Oh My Goddess that Torrance Smith had to promise to cover all the losses himself if it bombed. But it's still running today. I think it's the longest running manga in English now, actually. A little manga had been published before Mixing. Matt Thorne, who's a professor of manga at a university in Japan, had convinced Viz to publish some manga back in around 1994, but what he was into was more like Jose manga. It was more like adult shoujo manga. And so it didn't have quite as much, you know, appeal as the, you know, stuff like Sailor Moon. Of course, it didn't have a television show, you know, to cross-promote with. He did do some classic stuff, like They Were 11, this really excellent science fiction shoujo manga by Moto Hagio. And as other stuff came out, X-Men 99, Magical Maids, which was never fully translated. But Mixing, they had some weird things. For one thing, they did not use the term manga. They preferred to call it motionless picture entertainment, because they thought the word manga was weird, and this is the term Stu Levy made up. They also had a kind of a distinctive editorial voice. What's up, mixers? Now that most of you who are lucky enough to still be students are back in class for more education, oops, did I spell that wrong? When you're at Mix, ought to be kind of cool to give you even more drop-dead, slam-and-jam, and tear-jerk, and heart-yank, and funky-butt content for you to take to class. Since we know you'll be reading Mixing out of your desk instead of watching the chalkboard, geez, Stu, can you type any longer of a sentence? So that's Stu Levy, a.k.a. DJ Milky. Another problem with Mixing that people noticed was that in addition to Sailor Moon, it also ran the graphically violent horror manga Parasite. So in an attempt to, like, you know, get both fans of violent horror and Sailor Moon to read the same magazine, but some people objected to this. So they eventually split off Parasite into its own thing, and they split off into a separate shoujo manga magazine called Smile, which didn't have any decapitations. And they also, Viz at the time was all released a sort of a kind of an imitation magazine called Animerica Extra, which also published a cross of shoujo and shonen manga. And Dark Horse did Super Manga Blast, which was kind of similar. And Mixing kind of merged into a new magazine called Tokyo Pop. And eventually the whole company's name changed into Tokyo Pop. And so they are known today. So another thing that was going on at the time was that a couple manga artists had always insisted their work be published unflopped, right to left. And for the longest time, this had been a deal breaker, because no American comics publisher was willing to publish their stuff right to left. But some artists were very big on it, and one of them was Yoshiyuki Sadamoto, the creator of Evangelion manga. And so he insisted on having stuff published in the original format. Viz said, like, okay, why don't we publish in two formats, one left to right and one right to left. And he's like, okay. So Evangelion ended up being published in two formats, one of which also had untranslated sound effects, as you can see here. And another big name manga artist who also insisted on having his stuff published that way was Akira Toriyama. So Dragon Ball became the first fully right-to-left published comic. And Viz was afraid that no one would buy it and the sales would suck, but actually it sold pretty well. And actually, people had already, at this point, started becoming used to right-to-left manga, partly through scanlations, because of course most scanlations, I mean, were always right-to-left, which is why bother flipping it, and you know, it's just kind of more authentic that way, which is the same reason the Japanese artists, you know, feel that way about it. But meanwhile, something even bigger that was being brewed was about to give birth in America, and that was Pokemon! The Pokemon came around in like 1999, and suddenly it was a super, super mega hit, and anything associated with it was incredibly popular, and it pretty much started the like kids anime boom of the early 2000s. And also, Viz got the Pokemon comics license, and they printed millions of copies of the comics. It became super, super bestseller. Mostly not through comic stores, but through like bookstores and like toy stores. It had been censored a lot. You can see that, you can't see the original, but you can see that Misty's swimsuit has been changed into a very, very, like, all-encompassing wetsuit in these panels. But yeah, Pokemon was a big hit, and suddenly everyone knew that manga was mint money. 1999. Alright. I'm gonna speed up. Alright, 2002. So manga publishers now are aware they can make money by selling stuff in America. So one of those companies was Weekly Comic Bunch, published by Gatsun Entertainment. And Comic Bunch was a magazine that was actually formed by artists who split off from Shonen Jump, the most popular manga magazine in Japan. And so Comic Bunch decided, yes, we're going to try publishing our manga in America, because this is the time is right. And they launched this ambitious plan. And then coincidentally, perhaps, a few months later, Shonen Jump announced that they, too, were going to publish in America. Almost as if, out of rivalry for Gatsun, their hated enemies who defected from Shonen Jump, they decided to enter the American market just to stamp all over them. Anyways, I was the editor of Shonen Jump magazine. And this is an email I got from Sam Humphries, one of the editors of Gatsun, back in the day. And he challenged me to fight Yu-Gi-Oh! Punk ass, fight at the basketball courts. It would have been a pretty exciting fight, because that's him up there. That's him with his afro. It would have made a good manga. So yeah, Gatsun published, they did Raijin Comics, which was actually a weekly manga magazine. And which was super ambitious. And they had all this marketing money and poured all this effort into it. And meanwhile, Shonen Jump also poured tons of dough into put it coming out in the US. That's me in the upper left corner there. I had a trip to Jump Festa in Japan. And these two mega corporations, although actually the Raijin was only just like a mega corporation with one mega, clashed. And well, what was the result? Well, frankly, the Raijin stuff was all more of an old-school style of manga. The reason these people had split off from Shonen Jump was because they'd been popular in the 80s, and their art styles really weren't popular anymore with the same audience. They were more popular with older readers, you know, who had grown up reading this stuff. That kind of square-jawed, manly, macho manga style wasn't so popular anymore. I mean, now, like, more cartoony styles are more in, like, you know, One Piece or Shaman King, possibly. And so the result was that Raijin Comics collapsed miserably after a year. And although maybe, since as a former editor, Shonen Jump, maybe in bad taste for me to make this graphic. But nonetheless, tons of money was poured into the US market. And tons of people got to see ads for Shonen Jump and Raijin. Another thing was that all this manga was done right to left. And Tokyopop, at the same time, was also coming out with their first line of totally right to left manga. And what they were doing was they were actually doing something incredible and totally making this into a big selling point for the right-to-leftness, as opposed to like hiding it and making it a bad thing. It was 100% authentic manga, you know. And they did ads like this, talking about like, what if Superman's cape were flopped, so the S was backwards? Wouldn't that suck? You know, imagine what it's like for manga artists and stuff like that. And so, the sympathies of readers and fans really started to turn towards Tokyopop and towards right-to-left manga. Although there are still some holdouts, like Torrance Smith, like, why flop the pages? This is a subtitled movie, is unlikely to reach a large audience. Unflopped manga will certainly sell to almost nobody. And but then Stu Levy is like, Germans are doing it, you know, it's all right. I mean, let's just do it. Let's give it a shot. So, and another factor which I think was important is that translating the sound effects and flopping manga, typically at the time costs upwards of $30 a page. If you do the unflopped manga and the untranslated sound effects, like Tokyopop did, the lettering costs go down by about 10 times. So this was what enabled Tokyopop to start releasing $9.99 graphic novels and Viz selling graphic novels for like $15.95. Anyways, and also bookstores started to carry more of this stuff, partly due to people like Kurt Hassler, who was a buyer at Walden Books and went on to found Yen Press. 2003. Alright, the manga explodes outward. 80 Vision starts releasing manga, although they're not doing it anymore. Del Rey comes out with manga. That's Dallas Midoff of Del Rey. He was my editor on Manga the Complete Guide. That's his face. It's not a character in Tsubasa. And CMX, this is a subdivision of DC. Yaoi manga starts to be released in the U.S. from companies like Digital Manga Publishing and CPM's Be Beautiful line. Yaoi manga, of course, being another type of manga people would never thought would be published. The fantastically romantic and sexy stories of androgynous looking guys in love. A new shoujo magazine came out. Tokyopop Smile had been dead for several years, and now Viz has Shoujo Beat. And Josei manga, or ladies comics, the kind of adult equivalent of shoujo manga, started to be published in increasing numbers by companies like Aurora Publishing. Manga artists were now big enough stars that like Clamp go to Anime Expo and like have drawn and fill an entire auditorium. Gravitation EX became the first manga whose tankobon was simultaneously released in the U.S. and Japan. But Naruto is still like the most popular manga in the U.S. as of this moment, and the influence of manga spreads on to like original English language manga artists like Svetlana Chmakova and Felipe Smith, both of them totally excellent artists. And the work of American artists has also started to get recognized in Japan. Like the Japanese magazine Morning 2 has the Morning Manga Competition. Which is an international competition. It's open to the whole world. And the first competition was won by the American artist team Bakuri and Rim for their comic Kage no Matsuri. Another competition was sponsored by a branch of the Japanese government. It was the International Manga Award. And it was the first award won by Madeline Roska, the Australian author of Hollow Fields from Seven Seas Entertainment. That dude up there presenting the award to her is Taro Asa, who at the time was the Minister of Foreign Affairs, but is now the Prime Minister of all Japan, known as Rosen Asa, for his being a fan of Rosen Maiden. He's very outspoken about how otaku culture is Japan's like best hope for the world, and it will make everybody love them, and it's great. He's also known for some other controversial statements, such as when in 2001 he was quoted as saying he wanted to make Japan a country where rich Jews would like to live, and for other sort of inappropriate things he said, which you can all find on Wikipedia. Japan is doing what the Americans can't do. You can trust Japanese. It would probably be no good to have blue eyes and blonde hair. Anyways, so Taro Aso, Prime Minister of Japan. All right, so but irregardless, Korea was also getting in on the action. A lot of Korean manhwa has been translated. And I don't know how the sales figures compare to manga. Felipe Smith, who has MBQ I showed you a little earlier, recently became one of the few American artists to be blessed or cursed with having to do a manga serial for an actual Japanese manga magazine, Morning 2. His story, Pikachu, is running in the monthly magazine, Morning 2. He's living in Japan. Living the dream! You may have also heard of, there's an artist, I forget her name, who's working as an assistant to the creator of Prince of Tennis right now. She has a blog. So the boundary is breaking down. A lot of Americans are working in Japan, and Japanese artists are coming over to America, too, of course. All right, 2008. All right, so we got tons and tons and tons of manga publishers as of the beginning of 2008. But with this great success comes great troubles. For instance, censorship. Say you have a panty shot on the front cover of Tinto Tinge, your super violent and sexualized battle manga. You might just put the logo on top of the panties to cover it up. Say the title of your manga is 666 Satan. You can change it to also dirty sounding, but not obviously Oparts Hunter. Or say you have a scene of Shaman King, which I was forced to censor the scene myself actually. Where the character is crushed in the giant testicles of a tanuki. You might change it into a belly. Or even if someone is stubbing out cigarettes on Go Board, you can't show kids smoking in an all-ages title. Oh my god. So, what if he just puts gum on a Go Board instead? You can still see the wisp of smoke, though. They forgot to remove this. Alright, so, but nonetheless, no matter how much manga gets censored, it still seems, it still occasionally attracts controversy. It's just when Scholastic pulls his books for having cigarettes in them. Or with adult-themed comics at libraries shock parents, the Peach Girl, or all the naked guys' butts and Absolute Boyfriend. And what's odd, of course, is that I think the manga really could offend people rarely seems to get into the hands of anybody who would get offended. Like Nymphette, which Seven Seas almost published, the lolicon manga. Or the really non-consensual yaoi and adult manga, like Love's Like a Hurricane, which I can't even describe in public. And so yeah, there were many challenges. 2009. Alright, this is Al Khan, the CEO of 4Face Entertainment, the brought over Pokemon and Yu-Gi-Oh! And a couple other things. And he later became very cynical about the concept of manga. Kids in America aren't a reading culture. They're not going to start reading manga now. It'll never be a big deal. But that was in 2006. What did he say in 2007? I think it's over in Japan for the moment. Japan is tired. Manga is tired. For in your little world of manga publishing, you might be great, but in the real world, it's not working. So it's actually not for reasons like this. It's for the censorship of shows that one of the first Google hits for Al Khan comes up with a petition of how to kill him. But in any case, moving on. So this year, of course, it brought a lot of economic trouble, which affected manga companies as well. Tokyopop laid off almost half their staff back in June. Broccoli Books shut down in November. And even Viz laid off some people in February. With the economic downturn, and, a lot of bookstores also going under, and people begin thinking about, the future of print publishing in general, the future looks uncertain for manga in some ways. But on the other hand, it's really a problem of, if you look at it in another angle, manga is still extremely popular. It's just that, the distribution methods in the bookstores are having a lot of trouble. And, I certainly don't think that the vast influence of manga, that it's had in America is going to go away anytime soon. And there's plenty of untapped audiences that are still in red manga. Stuff like cooking manga and sports manga, in general, the more realistic manga. And as Carl Horn points out, we often forget the vast majority of Americans have never read a manga. So if they'll read Oishinbo or something like that, then perhaps a new manga boom can begin. And that is the fond hopes of some people in the manga industry. And that brings us back to Borders Bookstore. Actually, this is my room. So I'm Jason Thompson. This is my book, Manga the Complete Guide. Thank you for listening to me go on about manga.
Thank you very much, Jason.
No
problem. Just so you guys know, there's another manga that my manga can find this as well, but I'm sure that Jason can learn more about
it. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah.
Anybody have any?
Hey guys, so we have a draw, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
So, we play a ticket. So, if you'd like to play 3 tickets,
all right,
and then you have choice of 2 books from this pile.
I'll do that with great responsibility.
Okay.
All right, I'm seeing a...
Last 3 numbers.
560! You!
Do you want to come off
step forward?
Two? And then if you want to get 2 tickets.
Alright. Alright,
I got that right.
Yeah. Alright.
Awesome. I've never
wanted to
draw.
They are mostly, they're all
hand-pressed
books. Alright. And 558. I Alright,
so I'm going to pick two, and I've got one more, and then you'll just be left with the awesome book that I'm not
reading. Okay. Alright. Alright. Alright, it's 5:52.
Come on.
Oh, thank you.
Alright. Let's do a little.
Yep. Alright, I'm gonna start unpacking my computer. If anybody wants to know anything, or, you know, anybody wants any spare manga that I have laying on the house, come on over.
I thought you live in San Francisco.
I do, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so you'll have to drive to San Francisco.
You're gonna be sorry you said that.
Yeah, I don't think I'm that. You're on. Oh, you're on.
They're over there.